In this episode of the Encrypted Economy, we talk with Kurt Roelof, co-founder and CTO of Duality, one of the pioneers in the homomorphic encryption space. Kurt spent 9 years as a senior scientist at Raytheon, where he worked with the military's R&D arm, DARPA, which we learn a lot about in this episode, regarding homomorphic encrypted applications, as well as other things, before he went on to found Duality and Avometrics. Kurt has a real passion for cryptography. He loves the people that he works with who get it. When we talk about Brett Hemenway Falk, who was on our prior podcast, the people he worked with at DARPA, or the HE standardization group in the early days, he lights up. He loves the community. He is an engineer at heart. He wants to solve problems and make the world a better place. We talk about DARPA and get a reminder of how important the U.S. military has been in research and development for the whole world. What made homomorphic encryption really click for him? We talk about lattice-based cryptography, privacy-enhancing technologies, his work to standardize homomorphic encryption, and why it's important to keep cryptography open. Late in the interview, Kurt talks with great interest about the application of fully homomorphic encryption to healthcare research. He's particularly excited about genome-wide association studies and the potential application to cancer research. It's truly incredible. But why is it so important to protect this information to begin with? Now, you probably know that patient health information, or PHI, is protected by HIPAA, Health Information Portability and Accountability Act. Now, HIPAA provides the ability to research with de-identified data. You have to strip a list of identifiers from the data, but sometimes that de-identification also limits how that data can be used. But that's not all. One study that the Imperial College of London did last year, using a machine learning model and data sets that included up to 15 identifiable characteristics, age, gender, marital status, but de-identified, researchers were able to re-identify 99.98%, basically all, of the Americans in the de-identified data set. They were able to draw from 210 data sets that were gathered from 5 sources, including the U.S. government, that featured information on more than 11 million individuals. That's stunning. The black market for patient healthcare data is the most lucrative of stolen records markets because they have a longer shelf life, they're relevant for prescription, medical, and even pension claim. TrustWave did a report that found the selling price of $250 per HIPAA-protected record versus $540 for the next highest valued record. Now, I don't know if that's true in all cases, but the multiples are astounding. These are high stakes, and data subjects are people with medical conditions that could lead them to being targeted, health insurance and employment discrimination, and it could impact what they're able to be entitled to if they catch it. So this episode is a very rich episode, and Kurt, like Brett, is such a great foundational guest to speak about homomorphic encryption and privacy-enhanced technologies. I encourage you to listen to my early podcast with Brett, if you haven't already, as I think you'll benefit from listening to these two together. So without further delay, we start the episode with Kurt. And if you like the podcast, share it, talk it up, give us some feedback. Hope you enjoy it. Welcome to the Encrypted Economy, where we look at the business of regulation and security for all things encrypted, digital assets, blockchain technology, privacy, and smart contracts. Hope you'll join us while we explore these forces that are shaping the economy. Hi, this is Eric Hess with the Encrypted Economy. I'm excited to have Kurt Roelof with Duality, the CTO and co-founder of it, on the show to talk about the good work he's doing with privacy-enhancing technology and advanced cryptology. Kurt, really excited to have you on the show.
Great. Happy to be here. Thank you.
You've done a lot in this space. I can't do it justice even in summary. Do you want to give us a little bit of background about how you got involved in cryptology and current roles?
Yeah, I tongue-in-cheek jokingly say I got into cryptography by side channel attack. I'm a technical person, bachelor's, master's, PhD, all in electrical engineering. And post-PhD, I got pulled into the U.S. defense industry. And I'm actually trained as a control engineer and spent a lot of time developing high assurance software engineering, software systems, and things like that. Around 2009, there was this invention of this technology called homomorphic encryption that I was asked to lead a team to see if we could actually make it work for a part of the U.S. government called DARPA. And basically, the rest is history that I, for all intents and purposes, drank the Kool-Aid on this technology. And I've been running with it ever since for the past going on 12 years now.
Yeah, so for the listeners, DARPA is Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. It's intriguing their active engagement in this space. Do you kind of view their engagement as analogous to the U.S. government supporting internet technologies early stage?
Oh, exactly so. For those of you that aren't aware of the history, DARPA is the Blue Sky R&D wing of the U.S. military. And although it's very much a military, it has defense right in the name, it has developed a lot of the major groundbreaking technologies that we all rely on nowadays. We all like to point at, for example, GPS technology. The original ARPANET, which became the internet, was originally developed by an organization that is now called DARPA. And even email came out of this particular organization. I happen to have been fortunate enough to have been in the same group of the person who invented email, sat down the hallway from him. And so this whole legacy of DARPA investments in technology, I basically call DARPA the highest risk, highest reward VC organization on the planet for all the things that came out of it. And because it really very much is a technology investment organization with this wonderful legacy that they've developed of these civilization changing technologies like email, like the internet, like GPS and so forth. And I'm very proud to be part of this legacy.
We'll certainly get more into the public-private partnership for DARPA. Before we sort of get into it, I'd like to ask you a single event that shaped your life, whether your values, worldview, the way you look at the space that you're in now. If you could share a story, it'd be great.
So I've always been interested in technology as a technologist. But one thing that kind of shifted me and got me very kind of primed on the notion of privacy technologies and pushed forward is that there's no one event, but there's been this slow drip, and actually more of a kind of an open pipe of various kinds of data breaches, various organizations that have gotten hacked, either by criminals or nation states or other kinds of organizations, with this release of a lot of very sensitive personal information. And we can go back to the 90s, the 2000s, more recently with some of the recent revelations. And so there's no one thing, but this constant drumbeat of data leakage that's occurred over the decades has really gotten me thinking quite a bit about the notion of security and particularly privacy. We like to talk about data as being the new oil. And sometimes we even talk about data being the new plutonium, because this is very, very powerful capability. You can get a lot of value and a lot of benefit from data, and especially if you can share data. But in some sense, data can be very radioactive, like plutonium, and that you don't necessarily want to touch it because it brings all these liability issues about what if it's leaked, what if the wrong people get their hands on the data. And so one needs to find a way to share data, but also be able to get value of data and protect oneself from the liability of data, which is why we call it in some sense this radioactive substance like plutonium, which has a lot of value and has a lot of power associated with it. And up to now, when I say now, like in the past decade or so, data sharing has basically been protected by legal agreements, data use agreements and things like that, which can be slow, particularly compared to internet speeds and things like that. And so I've gotten really interested in how one could use privacy technologies to reduce the friction of data sharing, but at the same time also reduce liability and provide protections for people who want to share data and get value for data for any number of laudable reasons. For example, sharing medical information for cancer research, sharing financial information to reduce money laundering and fraud and all these other kinds of things to protect real people, real individuals, while also protecting their data and privacy at the same time.
That's a good point. It's interesting you brought up agreements. You know, you're talking to a lawyer, and I think about confidentiality agreements, and a lot of people just say, oh, well, it's in the confidentiality agreement. But the fact of the matter is confidentiality agreements are notoriously hard to enforce on. And the higher the stakes, the more likely companies are even willing to violate the confidentiality agreement to gain that edge. So building it in by design, it's exciting because it gets over that. I think the large companies with truly proprietary information, truly proprietary data, high sensitivity, they they don't want to leave it to having to enforce a confidentiality agreement that they may never even be able to identify. But by design, it enables things that just were never even possible before. So let me ask you on that point, you talked about the slow drift. So now I'm going to try to pin you down a little bit more. That what was the single data leakage event or the single thing that you experienced that sort of represented a shift in your mind? When that happened, you said, wow, things have changed. The direction has changed. And you've committing more to it at that point or just started to devote more of your mind space to the problem?
I think the one for me was something that was, I think, made a lot of waves in the defense industry, but didn't get as much attention in broader civil society, were the APT-1 style attacks that came out, if you remember these from, I forget the exact year they came out, roughly a decade or so ago. So the rough story is that, and there's this wonderful report that was put together by an organization that was at the time called Mandiant. I think they've changed their names a few times. It's called the APT-1 report. So APT stands for Advanced Persistent Threat. And there was an alleged nation state actor, and it's very hard to identify attribution in cybersecurity arenas, but there was a nation state actor who was allegedly infiltrating large organizations, you know, governments, universities, large corporations across the world, and over months and years were exfiltrating information from these various organizations. And as the cybersecurity people, we like to talk about defense in depth, about how no one tool, no one technique really provides strong guarantees about data leakage or cybersecurity, but you layer them together and you start to get stronger, you know, we're stronger together than we are apart, is kind of like the attitude that's always taken in cybersecurity. But there was this fundamental kind of challenge about how information generally tends to be shared and computed on in the clear. So if information needs to get out, needs to get shared, it has to be exposed at some level also, which also provides its own kind of challenges with cybersecurity. So rather than using just protection in transit, like you're encrypting files being sent over the internet, or just encryption at rest, which is shared on a disk, can you also provide encryption in use, being able to share data and compute on at the same time to provide this extra coverage that's not really protected through other traditional technologies? And so we can have basically end-to-end encryption, which also reduces the need to share encryption keys, reduces the need to store encryption keys, to basically reduce the attack surface of highly motivated, highly capable nation state style adversaries, like was used in the APT-1 reports. And it really was an eye-opening, really shocking report when it came out. And I still teach it even nowadays when I do teach. And so that was, in some sense, kind of the eye-opening thing for me about the value of data, how data could be such a challenging material that would really need to be protected by other means to reduce the attack surface of major organizations.
The APT reference is very apt, no pun intended, or maybe pun was intended, but it really gets to the heart of the use of the data. If you have an APT threat existing across your systems, those systems now are able to consume it when you consume the data, which is a real stunning element of APT, is that it's very pernicious. It spreads across the organization. And the model for these attackers is low and slow. They're not doing DDoS attacks. They're waiting, they're collecting, they're benefiting and at your expense. So that's a great example. So we've covered in some prior episodes with Brett Hemenway Falk, secure multi-party computation and homomorphic encryption, but we didn't actually cover lattice-based schemes. Can you offer a more of a layperson's explanation of lattice-based schemes?
Sure. So let's talk about why someone would actually want lattice-based schemes. And there's a few reasons. What we talk about when we talk about homomorphic encryption is the ability to encrypt data and then without decrypting, without sharing keys, to actually perform computations on that data. So there's been known for a long time that one could, with various schemes like RSA or the Polyea crypto system and things that are fairly legacy for quite some time, it's been fairly well known that one could run some limited computations, like add a bunch of integers or multiply numbers, not all at the same time. But there was this long interest in understanding how one can encrypt data and then run general computations. For example, run regression models, train machine learning models on top of encrypted data. And the fundamental discovery that I alluded to earlier in 2009, 2010 by a gentleman by the name of Craig Gentry, also happens to be trained as a lawyer. This is a little bit of an aside. Lawyers do everything, right? Yeah. which is that one could run these general computations on a family of schemes, which are called lattice crypto systems. And the major crypto systems, all crypto systems, secure crypto systems, are basically mathematical constructs. They give up basically, you know, for a late discussion, a recipe for how one manipulates numbers to represent data in ways that can't be understood or stolen from potential adversaries. And the mathematical properties of these protocols, these schemes, these algorithms are predicated on the hardness of certain mathematical properties. And so we're probably familiar with, like, for example, the RSA crypto system, which has been around since the 70s. And the RSA crypto system is based on the hardness of factoring two numbers. And then we have the lattice crypto systems, where the mathematical hardness properties that provide these capabilities are based on the hardness of performing some mathematical operations on matrices and numbers, things that look like lattices. And it gets a bit technical very quickly, but it's basically reducing problems to things that are highly dimensional linear algebra. And you get these properties where one can perform general homomorphic encryption, fully homomorphic encryption on these. And so that's one reason one would want to use lattice crypto systems. But there's this other also very big interest, which are also called post-quantum. And so the RSA crypto systems, which I alluded to, have this property where they can be attacked by quantum computing devices, devices where the underlying computation is not based on silicon transistors, but based on quantum physics. And lattice-based crypto systems are currently believed to be resistant to quantum computing attacks. And so there's been a big push by a number of nation states, including U.S. government through NIST, to develop and standardize post-quantum crypto systems, of which lattice crypto are one of the leading contenders, in addition to having these properties of fully homomorphic encryption and all these other really nice things that go along to it. So lattice crypto systems, it's basically the brave new wave of standardized crypto technologies as we're going forward.
That's a great example. I went through it. I could never explain it as well as you just did. And I can't say that I fully understand it, but I certainly could never explain it like you just did. So thank you. And it raises a point, because there's been a lot of discussion about FHE, which is fully homomorphic encryption, and somewhat homomorphic encryption, which is actually a term, somewhat homomorphic encryption. And it seems to me that fully homomorphic encryption is just one point on a continuum, not necessarily the end state you want to achieve, but it's representative of a potential end state, but there are a lot of different solutions that can go into any particular solution. Do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, no, sure thing. There is a general interest in what are called privacy technologies or privacy-enhancing technologies, PETs, also called PETs by shorthand sometimes. Various forms of homomorphic encryption are but one example. I know you had Brett Mouy-Falk on here before. He's a tremendous person. I have a lot of respect for him, both personally and professionally. And talking earlier on a different edition of the podcast about secure multi-party technologies, which is another very good way of various participants to collaborate on computations on data. A little bit different from encryption. It has other kinds of trade-offs where it can provide some nice performance applications, but, you know, has communication challenges where it requires a lot of bandwidth. There's other techniques like federated learning and a number of others, you know, some based on actual hardware, like trusted execution environments. And as we say, you know, the best tool for the job. Fully homomorphic encryption and somewhat homomorphic encryption, which is what I specialize in, and which is what we're commercializing at Duality, provide, in some sense, a more general capability with a number of malleable capabilities for enabling computation on data which has been encrypted without necessarily the online participation of every participant. It comes with trade-offs associated with computability and several of the things related to performance that I'm happy to dig into and talk about where one would use it. But as we say, it's use the best tool for the job. And we have this company, Duality, which is basically commercialized homomorphic encryption for a number of applications where we see there's a lot of value in these technologies.
Interesting. So let me ask you this question. Do you foresee a use case for using both SMPC side by side with somewhat homomorphic encryption?
I do. And so side by side, I'll go back to what I said before, is about the right tool for the job. There are different use cases where one would use MPC. There are definitely use cases where one would use homomorphic encryption or fully homomorphic encryption. In terms of tying the two together, I could see that. Cases where There might be some data that's already encrypted using homomorphic encryption, and then providing some sort of dynamic integration of data that might be like a live stream or something like this, using secure multi-party type techniques where there might be a lighter duty computation that one can run on secure multi-party. And so it is, like I said, it is very much a bit of a nuanced field about what to choose when, about when to go and mix these things together. It's part of the research of why technologists like myself get up in the morning to dig into these things.
And so let's say that you had to go to a venture capitalist and explain the compelling case for duality. How would you do so?
Right.
I'm not putting you too much on the spot here.
No. It's actually something that we've, of course, the nature of being a co-founder and a CTO of a startup is one gets very comfortable with this proverbial elevator pitch. Although if you're good at elevator pitches, the conversation goes on for a lot longer than an elevator ride. So duality, we've had a number of really nice investments from a number of organizations like Intel Capital, Hearst Ventures, and Teammate, which is an Israeli-American cybersecurity investor. And where we have been basically talking with our investors early on is about how duality, although we're well known for our background in homomorphic encryption, we have a very strong team, both co-founders and core employees. But we are very much a data science company, as much as we are a homomorphic crypto company. And there are very, very few organizations that want to buy homomorphic encryption or secure multi-party or federated learning just for homomorphic encryption or just for secure multi-party or just for federated learning. What people really want and what customers really want are the ability to do computations, queries, manipulations, analytics, machine learning, collaboration on sensitive data. And it really is all about the data and how one can collaborate on data and share data and go forward from there. And we like to talk about a number of use cases that we've had, such as helping to fight financial fraud by allowing investigators to encrypt queries, send these queries off to banks, run computations on banks' data to help support investigations to fight fraud. We like to talk about examples where we partnered with Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and with support from National Institute of Health to allow cancer research centers to share encrypted genomic data to better identify or better leading indicators of cancer and other kinds of pernicious diseases and things like this. And for all these use cases, for example, NIH, Dana-Farber, cancer researchers, they could care less about homomorphic crypto, secure multi-party, federated learning. What they care about is the ability to get access to data and compute on data. And we want to provide value and provide value by providing these tools. And I somewhat tongue-in-cheek like to talk about how my mission, as much as I've drank the Kool-Aid on homomorphic encryption, my mission is to make it as boring as possible so that people can use these technologies and not know they're there and not care that they're there or not, other than that they get access to the data and have some sort of guarantee that the underlying data that they have access to is correct and trusted and private and secure.
Is it really possible to make people not know that it's there? You do work with Avometric. And Avometric, in referencing what you do, is you work with legacy systems on privacy enhancement and the like. When you deal with legacy systems, what are the challenges you face in trying to apply privacy-enhancing technologies to legacy systems?
Right. So this is a great question. So one of the reasons, one of the kind of the pushes that we've had, at least the original co-founding team of Duality, is we were working for a project for DARPA back in the day, in the mist heap of 2012, 2013, is that we were able to get homomorphic encryption, fully homomorphic encryption, somewhat homomorphic encryption, deployed when was at the time the stock iPhone, the iPhone 5Ss. And for those of you who are familiar, this was the first iPhone that had a 64-bit processor. I forget how much memory it had, but not that much compared to modern standards. And we were able to install an app that we designed on these iPhone 5Ss that would basically perform multi-party voice over IP. And so what this means is that the phone would basically listen on the microphone, like how we're talking now on this podcast, digitize the voice data, encrypt it using homomorphic crypto, send it off over commercial networks, commercial data networks, 3G networks, for example, perform data filtering, data mixing on what was then the stock free tier of AWS, micro instances, and do mixing all well encrypted, and then send the data back to the iPhone 5S node and play back the sound. And so we were getting audio quality that was pretty comparable to what we have right now here on this podcast several years ago. And this opened our eyes that, this stuff was real and it was performant and very usable. And we started getting a lot of interest from a lot of our sponsors about how they could add layers of security onto existing deployed systems, henceforth defined legacy systems. And you know, US government has all kinds of 32-bit processor systems, low memory systems. And we designed this open source library, which we use quite heavily, called Palisade, specifically to be as modular as possible, to not only just provide lattice-based crypto and homework for crypto, but to also be easily deployable on a wide array of compute environments. So not just the Dell servers and AWS servers, but also on Android and iOS and legacy 32-bit processors and a lot of these software-defined radio systems even, which are very, very low resourced compared to the modern laptop and things like that. And so this was a lot of the early interest that we had in these technologies about how to deploy not just on enterprise systems, but on mobile and even mobile systems that have been around for decades or more.
Wow. And so you talked a bit about Palisades. There's certainly a number of these libraries that are out there. How does the universe of all these libraries coexist? Are certain libraries better for certain use cases? Does it inhibit the standardization? Does it facilitate the standardization? Because it's just, there's a few different ones. And so how does one looking at these libraries sort of make determinations as to what's fit for purpose?
This is a great question. And so we broadly defined my partners at Duality, my collaborators through DARPA, partners and other defense contractors and in academia, co-founded a live open source library that we call Palisade, which supports the leading homomorphic crypto schemes. There's a laundry list of a few of them that we support, particularly with a focus on hardware integration and hardware deployments and usability in production-ready environments. And there is a very healthy ecosystem of various open source libraries for homomorphic crypto. There's a few which are driven by more industrial research. There's a few that are driven more by academic research. I am a firm believer in Duality. We are very firm believers in open source because we believe that only open crypto should be used to help build trust in the technology and help engender trust in the technology. What we do is that we only use open protocols, which have been vetted by peer review in the academic literature. We only use open source implementation. Anyone can download the Palisade library and look at all the crypto that we use. And then we are very, very active engaging in standardizations of these technologies. And that there are multiple libraries is very important for certain standardization process. For one, it gives a very clear signal to the international standards bodies and national standards bodies, whether it's NIST, ISO, IEEE, ITU, that there is an active commercial industry associated with the use, development, application of homomorphic encryption, so that there is a need to standardize and standardize not just security settings, but also APIs, SDKs, and all the other nice things that go into library standardization. And it also provides a degree of crypto agility so that one could use different protocols or even different libraries if one wanted to for our customers. And so although we firmly believe about the importance of homework for crypto, it kind of goes back to what I said before, we're as much a data science company as it is a crypto company. And we basically give away our crypto for free in our open source library for anyone to go use and build themselves and apply. And we have had a number of competitors that have actually used our library, which we're happy to point at and encourage them to do also, because it just shows how trusted the library is also. But that being said, yeah, there are other major libraries. Microsoft Research has their library. IBM Research has their library. There are a number of academics that have put them out, and they all have their purposes. Our library at Palisade, like I said, is very heavily used by us at Duality. It's been adopted by the NumFocus Consortium of Data Science Libraries. This is the same group that does PandaForge, NumPy, SciPy, and we think it's very important to be part of a community, not just for best practices, but also help to build trust in the technologies of what we're doing.
Yeah, now you've been, from the get-go, a big proponent of standardization. In fact, were you a founding member of the homomorphic standardization group? You were a founding member, right?
Yes, I am.
Tell me about the evolution of the HE standardization group, where it is now, and how you see its vision going forward.
So this actually came about in one of the early DARPA projects where I was talking with Shai Halevi, who was one of the main people behind the HE Lib library. And we started talking about standardization and through an accident of geography. I'm based in New Jersey. Shai is based in across the Hudson River over in New York, in addition to my longtime collaborator partner, Yuri Polykov, and Shai's longtime collaborator partner, Victor Shoup, who's a professor at NYU. And we got to talking about standardization. And it just so happened that one of the key people, core people from the Microsoft team, a lady by the name of Kristen Lauder, who is now very high up in the R&D of Microsoft, who was also a big proponent of Homework for Crypto and had fostered with her collaborating partner, Kim Lina at Microsoft, the SEAL library. And it happened to be that over 1 week, we were all in New York City at the same time. And it was a bit of a funny thing. We met up in Columbia University. Somehow, my recollection is basically, commandeered a meeting room in one of the libraries in Columbia and started to talk about how we could start to standardize the various libraries and what it meant. And through support from IBM, support through a number of the government organizations, support through Microsoft, this organization just took off. And we ended up co-founding this group, homomorphicencryption.org, still active. And we started having meetings every several months. We had a meeting at MIT that I think had 70 people. We had a meeting at Toronto, University of Toronto, that had close to 100. We had a meeting before the pandemic at Intel headquarters that had, I think, 120 people, if I'm not mistaken. And participation from major organizations, Intel, Samsung, different parts of the U.S. government, different parts of foreign governments, the Korean Credit Bureau was at them. And it just really was a very exciting, kind of very heady atmosphere where we could start to define standards for security settings, for protocols, and then started getting uptake and participation from major international organizations like the United Nations ITU, International Telecom Union, IEEE and ISO, and we've since spun off a number of working groups of these major organizations to foster the further adoption. And this Homework for Crypto organization that we co-founded was always a means to the end to show that there's both a cohesive group and also foster adoption by these larger international organizations like ISO, IEEE, ITU, and NIST, and so forth.
So in these meetings early on, did you endeavor to sort of square standardization with the potential security risks from being open and standardized?
So this is in some sense almost like a point of near religious belief among a large body of cryptographers that crypto needs to be open, crypto needs to be inspected. Security by obscurity is how we somewhat disparagingly call it when organizations try to provide crypto solutions which are not public and not open and not known. We think that we are stronger together than we are apart. And so that even if you look at the major open source crypto libraries, a lot of us use the same protocols underneath, so to speak, the BFV protocol, BGB, CKKS, and so forth. And there is a very firm belief among, the broader community that the crypto protocols really do need to be open to help not just with trust, but also to make sure that bad crypto doesn't get used. Because in some sense, for us as a community, reputation is very important. And the best way to maintain reputation is to make sure that only the best crypto actually gets used. And this openness is a way of helping to foster that.
And I imagine it also facilitates auditability of the various frameworks. If you're trying to figure out what it is that your system is doing that's fully encrypted, it's good that knowledge is shared and that the people who are auditing it can actually determine what it is that you're encrypting versus an organization doesn't do as well, disappears, and now you're stuck with a system that isn't as malleable as you'd like. So great point. Duality has a product called Secure Plus Statistics. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, happy to. So there are a couple different ways that we at Duality are commercializing homework encryption. And we have a product line called Secure Plus, and we provide a couple different functionalities, one of which, for example, is Secure Plus Query, which I alluded to before, which allows queries to be encrypted and then run on data. And so it protects the privacy of the query itself. And then there is another product offering that we call Secure Plus Statistics. And this fits in the more classic homework for crypto model, which allows someone to encrypt data and then run computations on encrypted data for the various bread and butter statistical operations. Mean, standard deviations, you know, the kind of things that the statistical analysts, you know, particularly financial statistical analysts, will often want to do in their use cases. And so it really pushes forward this model of homework for crypto as a viable capability ready for general use.
Before we were talking about how you explain duality to a venture capitalist and the drivers for it, and how even your evolution contemplated the various APTs and how they impacted the need for photography. Solar winds, obviously, has grabbed a lot of people's attention, obviously grabs the government's attention and resources and efforts. How does solar winds fit into the homomorphic encryption and advanced cryptography narrative?
That's a great question. There's a few angles associated with it. Probably the biggest one, as I alluded to before, was this notion of defense in depth, that there's no one tool that's going to be the end-all be-all, and you really shouldn't trust any one tool. You know, SolarWinds was also an interesting challenge associated with the method of attack, being that it was kind of a production attack, as they call it. And this also notion of rapid cyber threat intelligence sharing. One of the challenges with cybersecurity, and particularly nation-state cybersecurity, is that attacks can be very fast moving, and often human-in-the-loop analysts are a bit slow. They're good. I don't want to disparage any of the cyber analysts or cyber warriors that we have. But, you know, people are slower than computers. It's just the nature of silicon versus mind and body. And often there is a need for increased automation for these kinds of tools. There's also a need for collaboration, where any one organization might not have a wide enough view to see things that are going on, like these various widespread APT attacks. And I'll bring it back, you know, particularly with APT1. The reason Mandiant was able to identify these reports in such a dramatic way is that Mandiant, organization that was called Mandiant at the time, was one of the leading cybersecurity vendors across Western society. And so they had views of the New York Times, major other organizations, so they could start to aggregate information in a trusted way. And this need of aggregating information is critical for the broader society. And some aspects of DHS, Department of Homeland Security, play parts of this role, but there is a need for increased automation of these capabilities. And so we've recently signed a contract with DoD DARPA, particularly to enable machine learning for cyber threat intelligence sharing. And so we have this activity that we're pushing forward with a defense contractor partner that allows us to train on shared cyber feeds to build models of what attacks are looking like as they're occurring in a privacy-preserving manner. Because organizations, whether it's companies, U.S. government organizations, or so forth, are very, very hesitant to share cyber data. And so as part of a DARPA initiative to foster machine learning on private data, we're working on an application that allows us to train cyber attack models on threat intelligence data on live streams and going forward from there. So some of the things that we're tied into, both in terms of augmenting the current tools and also pointing at the need for general collaboration on data, allows us to better detect these various kinds of pernicious attacks.
Certainly AI in cybersecurity is a growing area, particularly given the complexity of threat modeling. So you talked a bit about DARPA. Let's talk a little bit more about the public-private partnership, you know, the work that you continue to do at DARPA. I noticed that you even got a faculty award. So I guess NGIT is wrapped into the DARPA initiative. Your work with them continues. They continue to be a partner. Do you want to give some color on that relationship, that continuing of relationship?
Sure. So like I said before, DARPA is probably the most risk-friendly, highest return on investment VC firm that ever existed. I very firmly believe this, despite being an entrepreneur and a big fan of the VC business model. I see DARPA as an outright good for society with all that they've been able to do and all the technology they've been able to foster just to make society better in many, many ways. And as a part of that, you know, one of the things that happened very early on when homomorphic crypto was first discovered, when Craig Gentry had his first paper on this, is that there was a DARPA PM at the time by the name of Drew Dean, who saw the technology and also had this really wonderful vision that if you go look at historical encryption technologies like RSA, RSA was, depending on whether you talk to the Americans or British, were discovered in early 70s. And RSA crypto systems wasn't really widely used in public society roughly until the 90s with the internet. So there's about a 20-year lag. And then you look at like elliptic curve crypto. Elliptic curve crypto was invented in the 80s. It really wasn't used in widespread commercial use until roughly the 2000s with Blu-ray players, for example. And so Drew Dean at the time, you know, he told me the story about how he looked at this kind of like 20-year lag of, you know, crypto invention to actual widespread use. and really thought that with the bright investment of technology development, that these homomorphic crypto technologies could be accelerated from production use from 20 years to 10 years and knock off a decade of wait time until organizations could start to use these technologies more widespread. And so you fostered this DARPA Proceed program, which I was a PI, principal investigator on. There was a series of subsequent follow-on programs that have been very active, which contributed to Palisade, used Palisade, for example. And lo and behold, here we are roughly 10 years later. And you know, not only us, but there are a number of companies that are commercially developing homomorphic encryption and other privacy technologies 10 years ahead of schedule, which is kind of exciting. And I do bump into Judine every few years. And the next time I talk with him, I'll have to tell him about how his 10-year vision is coming to fruition. And this visionary that he was really quite spot on about the power of a public-private partnership fostered by DARPA to push forward this commercial technology in a way that cut 10 years off its life cycle in a very good way.
And that's significant. I know you have a lot of use cases that you're pursuing, so I'm not asking you to pick a favorite child here. But when you think of the potential velocity of improvements, the rich use cases and the opportunities, one particular use case that you're particularly excited about that really sort of captures your imagination, share with us why.
Right on. So I'm a big fan of training on encrypted data. I think it's the kind of thing where when one wants to do machine learning, the data is really the major challenge. And when we talk to data scientists, you talk to machine learning practitioners. Practitioners use a really small set of models. Things like logistic regression is like the 80% solution for data science and machine learning in production use, whether it's in healthcare, whether it's finance, whether it's in other applications. And the next most common is generally things like convolutional neural nets and things like that. Training on encrypted data has been classically very, very hard to do. And we are starting to make headway on it, for example, through this DARPA program called CSL, which I alluded to before, and some other things that are coming down the pipe. And whereas we can run general computations like risk score modeling, inference computations on data, we have been able to for several years and do it quite practically and feasibly for commercial use, we are just now turning the corner and have some really early production usage of training on encrypted data. And we see it basically opening the floodgates for a next wave of use of homomorphic encryption and privacy technologies in general. And so we expect to see a lot of announcements of this coming out, not just from us, but from others. But we're definitely in the thick of things as we are pushing forward. And it's something that me and my hat as CTO and technologist, I'm really quite excited about, not just the duality, but in the broader industry too.
And do you see healthcare as being one of the first cases to really run with this training of encrypted data through machine learning, or not necessarily so?
I do see healthcare. You know, the industries which have had the earliest, fastest uptake of homomorphic encryption technologies have what we call regulated data industries, finance, healthcare. And the example that we've been pushing on in collaboration with NIH and Dana-Farber and so forth has been on things that are broadly called genome-wide association studies, or GWAS. And we've had a number of papers that have been published that our team did in the Proceedings of the National Academy and so forth about how one could use homomorphic encryption to perform these kinds of studies and build models of how genetic mutations are indicative of various kinds of cancers and other kinds of disease, severity of COVID-19 infection, and so forth. And we do see healthcare as a very valuable use case with very sensitive data that really needs to be protected for very good, compelling reasons related to privacy and medical efficacy going forward.
So 10 years from now, how do you think the world will view the work that Duality, the HE standardization group, and other companies like Duality has done in this space?
Well, you know, I'll somewhat tongue-in-cheek go back to what I said before about my mission of making homomorphic crypto boring. I see it as kind of like how people treat the internet nowadays. Like, yeah, it's a cool thing, but you know, it's there. It works. And in some sense, I see this as kind of being like this expression that we have, this hindsight 2020. You know, 10 years from now, I really hope people look back at it. It's like, yeah, that was the obvious thing to do. You know, of course they should have done that. So, you know, such is my dream.
Right. But we still look back and see what Bill Gates, we talk about Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, even though what they've created has become ubiquitous in our society. So who knows? Maybe you're part of that crew. Who knows? But Kurt, listen, it was great to have you on the show. Really exciting stuff. And thanks for sharing all your knowledge with us.
Well, thank you again. This was a great conversation. Happy to be part of it.